every day, everywhere. And I probably need to refine that, because what tends to happen is I come up with these titles earlier in the week and then I change my mind. It happens quite a lot. So we did in this kind of thematic study of the book of Numbers, we first looked at things we can know about God from the book of Numbers. And following that, things we can learn about God's people. And then we looked at God's leaders as well. And now we're looking at the law, because obviously the book of Numbers contains a great deal of law. And so here's my second title: Law, a sign of a very present God. Okay? Law, sign of a very present God. Now, if I mention the word law, most people, in the main, have a less than favorable response to that word. It conjures up for a lot of people something rather inflexible, firstly. I think, you know, as human beings, being made of flesh, we're quite flexible. So the idea of law, something rather immovable, can be a bit off-putting, a bit cold perhaps, a little bit impersonal. And I suppose very imperfect as well, because if you notice, every law you make, people make, you then almost have to modify those laws and change them, and then you have to make another law to catch the loopholes, and you're constantly having to evolve and develop. It's trying to catch this pursuit taking place. It's very, very impractical. In one sense, it's very impractical, because you can have all these laws, and even if they're good, you've still got to prosecute, you've got to track people down and get evidence. It's a very complex process, isn't it, the whole business of law. And even when you've got it and you've got the satisfaction of a conviction and even punishment, still does one ever feel that the whole matter is finally dealt with and things hang? So law is, seems to a lot of people, something of a necessary evil, if I can put it like that. A necessary evil. It's slightly impersonal and full of penalties and clauses and fines and all the things that we don't particularly like. A necessary evil. But in the book of Numbers, we're looking at one of the five books that are called the law, right? The books of the law. The Hebrew word there is Torah, which I'm sure you all know. And the word Torah means the aim, the thing that, the target, the thing one aims at. So a sinner is a person who misses, and the Torah is the target which that person is supposed to aim at. You're supposed to aim at that way of life and to keep conform to that way of life. And if one doesn't hit the target, one has sinned. It's a kind of, the word sin is a technical term from archery, which obviously was the main, you know, one of the great methods of warfare at that time. So it's quite important to be able to hit your target if you were going to be successful. It was an important skill for people to have. If you failed in that, that was a sin, and that word has then been imported to be used as falling short of keeping the law, the aim which God has given us for our lives, how we're to live our lives. And when you look at this, these five books, the five books of Moses, the Torah, the law, the Bible in Hebrew terms is broken down into three sections. You've got Torah, which is the law. You've got Nevi'im, which is the prophets. And you've got Ketuvim, which is the writings. So it's all the wisdom, literature, and the histories in those three sections. When you're looking at the Torah, it could just come across as this great big legal compendium, this great big dusty book full of laws and rules and regulations and commandments that people find less warm than perhaps other parts of the Bible. And so maybe don't give it the time and the effort that it deserves. Full of covenants, and it has got covenants, isn't it? It's a book of covenants. I don't know how many covenants you can cite from the Torah, from the law. Give me, we've got the law, we've got the covenant, Moses. Yeah, one, certainly. Noah? Yes, there's a covenant with Noah, isn't there? Abraham? Three. Adam? Wouldn't you say as well, there's a covenant there? Do we agree there's a covenant with Adam? Yes, there is. That's right. There's also an inherited covenant, isn't there? And so on. So there are several covenants, legal commandments and restrictions and so on and so forth. Lots of regulations, stipulations, statutes. And yet we were reading earlier, weren't we, about this man who wrote this psalm, Psalm 119, and he absolutely loves it. It's his delight. And that should make us stop and think. It should arrest us a little bit, because here is something that might not be something we have a natural affinity to, but the writer, in the psalmist, finds a way into the law that makes it something that is deeply, deeply satisfying and engaging and helpful to his spiritual life. And I don't think he's just sort of a perverse person. It's a very much the song of somebody who has a whole and right attitude to God and to God's word. So I don't think we need to kind of rebrand the law and try and make it seem more appealing. I don't think we need to get a PR agency to come make the Torah seem more attractive to us. Jesus himself, when he speaks about the books of Moses, he says, "Have you not heard what Moses has said?" And he says, "Isn't it not written in the law?" He doesn't shy away from this word law. There is a law, there is a means by which one can delight in the law. And if you think about what the psalmist is saying there, Psalm 119 is so full of praise. We can't believe that this was something that was praiseworthy at a time, but is no longer of any value or interest to us today, as if somehow that's all been put aside in the Old Testament. But I think what's changed, surely, the thing that I hope has changed for each one of us is the idea, what cannot be our way into the law, is the idea that keeping the law is the means by which you are going to try and obtain righteousness and salvation. If you're trying to do that, this is going to be a constant source of misery and disappointment, and you will not achieve what you're out to pursue. But there is obviously a delight to be had in the law. As far as Jesus is concerned, when it comes to the law, he says it's to be fulfilled. He absolutely throws himself, his whole life and energy, into fulfilling the law. Such is his delight in it that there's nothing he seems to be more preoccupied with than investing his entire life into it. So that's something that should make us think as well. And as far as Paul goes in Romans chapter 8 and verse 4, he describes the requirements of the law, not just, you know, the demands that it makes upon us, as being righteous. So it's entirely good, entirely noble and acceptable and so on and so forth. So he describes the law as having making a righteous demand and requirement upon us. So at least we should be stopping and thinking about law, about Torah. I wonder if you get put on the spot by somebody and they say the five books of Moses, what is it? Basically, what's in them? You know, you're a Christian, you read the Bible, I'm pretty ignorant about all these sort of things. Describe it to me. Tell me what are these books? What have we got here? I wonder what you would your general answers might be. What kind of area might you be answering them? So that's interesting. Thank you, Walter. Yes. There's some history in there, isn't there? But not just something that's long ago, is it? But it's got a narrative to it. It's got a story, hasn't it? Yes. Is that what you'd start off if you were trying to explain something? The books of Moses. What else? Yep. A history of God's dealings with people. Yes, the Israelites in particular. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. Lessons. All right. Things that are taught us there. Absolutely. Full of lessons, isn't there? There's lots you can learn from the Torah, absolutely. Nobody's actually saying much about law, are they? They're not saying much. You talk about the five books. Would anybody here go say, well, the Ten Commandments? Yes? The Ten Commandments and all the regulations about the sacrifices and what the priest should wear and how the temple should be laid out. There's lots of detail and regulation, but there's also loads of story, there's loads of history, there's loads of things you can learn from people's lives, isn't there? It's a real combination of these two different things. I know you know these things. I'm just making you stop and think about it for a moment. And if you look through the book of Numbers, which is what we're looking at tonight, this is very imprecise, but bear with me. If you just open it from the beginning and you look at, say, the first chapter, there's a whole set of regulations there at the beginning, counting people, setting out all their names and putting them all in order. And then as you that goes on and on, and then you get the Levites there, and then chapter 2, the ranging and setting out of the camp and what the Aaronites have to do and how the redemption should be made for the firstborn in chapter, at the end of chapter 3, chapter 4, the duties of the Kohathites, and then chapter 5, what you do with unclean people, and confessions and tests for adultery there in page 113, Nazarite vows going on, offerings in the tabernacle. So all these things, these regulation, rule, and so on and so forth. The lampstands, how a lampstand is to be made, how the Passover is to be celebrated in chapter 9, and going on. And you keep going through into chapter 10, the silver trumpets and the cloud. And then suddenly in chapter 10, verse 11, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud lifted off the tabernacle of the testimony, and the people of Israel set out. So you've got this big investment of kind of laws and regulations, and then the next minute, it's like we're on the move again. And that continues on as you read on. The people complain. There's the incident in chapter 11, the people complaining. And then the elders are appointed to help Moses. It's an event that takes place. And then the quail in the end of chapter 11 there, all these birds fly over. And then there's a plague that breaks out. There's a rebellion. Miriam and Aaron oppose Moses. Spies go into the promised land in chapter 13 and so on and so forth. You carry on and get into chapter 14 there. There's a big rebellion. It's all narrative, isn't it? And then when you get down to chapter 15, suddenly, after Israel's been defeated in battle, we're back to laws. Chapter 15, sacrifices now. Laws about intentional sins, laws about unintentional sins, breaking the Sabbath, tassels on your garments. And then chapter 16, all that stops and we're back into rebellion. This time it's Korah's rebellion. It goes on. We're going to just do a little survey of the book here. Chapter 17, the appointing of people into the ministry. There's Aaron's staff buds and the staffing crisis. And chapter 18, duties of priests and Levites are going back into laws and regulations. Chapter 19, laws and regulations. Chapter 20, Miriam dies. Okay, I probably, you know, I don't want to take you through the whole book, you know, but you get the idea, don't you, that you've got a section of law followed by a section of narrative followed by a section of law by a section of narrative. And these two things are woven together. These two things weave together all the way through the book. And I think if you follow through the book, you'll see the pattern just continues all the way through. So what we're getting here is the idea that law is some separate impersonal thing begins to disappear in the fact that all these laws are appearing in the course, the ordinary course of people's lives. That's the point I'm trying to get across to you. Is that here's people living out their lives, and the law comes to people as they live their lives. The word of God comes to them as they live and breathe. And the things that they're doing, that the kind of people they are, and their very needs, are really what produce the law. So the laws come up. So we looked at the murder law there, in chapter 35. And here's a law that is brought to bear upon them about the way that it should be dealt with if a person kills another person. And you realize that this is not an abstract thing that somebody's thought about at a distance. This is a very close and personal observation of human beings and what people are like. That people have these passions and they have these animosities, they have these frictions and tensions and temptations and the way they try to resolve their problems. And here's two people in particular they're talking about, this sort of two men. A man kills a person. If anybody kills a person becomes a murderer. Somebody has actually made a decision or an action in a moment and they've taken somebody's life. And that is as down to earth and awful and fleshly and visceral as anything you can imagine. There's nothing impersonal about this. You know, when you've taken somebody's life, this is, as, in one sense, is as personal as it gets. And the law comes to the people in the midst of their circumstances, in the reality of who they are. It's not out there somewhere. It's dealing with, here's a man with blood on his hands. And God speaks concerning that person and speaks concerning that situation. It's not far off. God is near. So what I want to just make point is that all these laws are a record of people's real lives, what real people are like the things that they really want to do, the things that they really need or try. And God comes in his word alongside them as they live out their lives and observes their lives very closely and guides them and gives them commandments and directions as they need them. So he loves them through the law. You know, nobody wants to become a murderer, in truth, you know. But you get to a point where, so the law comes to you to chasten you and to sober you and awaken you and stir you and make you think about your life and make you think about the consequences of your life, the decisions you're about to make. In the law, you hear God calling you, don't you, to live close to him and turn away from yourself and from your own actions. So the laws cover every aspect of people's lives. We haven't got time to go through it all, but there are laws here about their social interactions, about their politics, about their religion, about their ethics, and even down to what they eat. And so God's word, God's law, is not just a set of things that you know and delight. It's no delight in it in something that you just know about. It's something you delight in as you live it, as it's been lived out in your life. The word comes to a person trying to live out a life pleasing to God, and the law helps them live their life before God in every area of their lives. And they get to love God in realizing how the law helps them and steers them and guides them. And they come to delight in the law, which keeps them on track. It keeps them going forward and stops them from falling into the kind of problems that they wouldn't want for themselves. So people have needs, don't they? People have needs. I have needs, you have needs. Left to our own devices, what are people like when left to their own devices? And so one of our great needs, we need to be mastered, don't we? We need a Lord. We need one who will master us and show us the way and lead us and keep us from the worst aspects of ourselves and keep us going on the road. And here we see God revealing his very nature to them by giving them these laws. He loves them. That's why he speaks to them. He shows them his care by giving them direction for life in all the areas that actually concerned them, that interested and mattered to them, and it involved them every single day. So these books have a whole encyclopedia of their experience of people living out their lives before God. This book and Book of Numbers, all the five books of Moses were written around about the time, this 40 years of travel, when Moses was in the wilderness for those 40 years. During that period, that's the time when Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers were written. And they answer all sorts of questions that people were having. So the book of Genesis answers the question, how did we end up in Egypt? How did we end up here in the first place? Read the book and you'll find out. And the idea that children are growing up not knowing how did we get out of Egypt, the book answers, this is how the Lord brought us out of Egypt and what he's done. And now they're out there in the wilderness and they're no longer under the impression of the gods of Egypt. How should we live our lives? Leviticus shows, well, this is how you should worship God and how you shall know him. And in the book of Numbers, where should we go from here? Sits them the vision of going to Canaan and inhabiting it and taking their journey through the wilderness. So when people dismiss the law, what they're dismissing is their lives and the way that God is dealing with their lives. So the law records God's interest in their life. God's interest in their life. And lastly, and here's the real thing. It's about the source of all this life and law. Where is God? Where is God? And one could look, if you're living at that time, you'd be able to look across to the tent and there would be the tabernacle. And you'd be able to look across and say, there is God. You'd be able to see him every single day in your tent. You'd be able to look up and you'd be able to see the place where God inhabited. And that must have been a great comfort to them, I would have thought. Just to be able to look across and say, oh, there's the Lord. There's the Lord. And as time goes forward and they go into the promised land, they build a temple. And though the land was much bigger and they were much further away, Tim and I were talking about this, much further away, they could still make a pilgrimage and go and see that place and go, oh, there's the Lord. The Lord is in our midst. And then, of course, after that, they went into exile and they were seemingly further away from those signs. And they couldn't see him. And they wanted to be in the country and they couldn't be there. But the one thing that was left with them, the thing that they had all through that was the word, was the law, wasn't it? That kept with them. So the law came to them at that time in the wilderness through the mouth of the prophet. And the prophet is, of course, Moses. So God appoints a human being just like them to be with them, to keep company with them, to experience all the things that they experience, and to bring his word to them in words they could understand and follow, somebody who's with them. And then after he's gone and they move on, the words are still there, and they can come to the words. They may not be able to see God so clearly, but they can still hear his voice speaking to them through the words that he's left behind. And as they drift further away, nevertheless, the word abides with them wherever they go. So when we see this chapter of this, anyone killing another person, the murderer shall be put to death, and so on and so forth, you realize that God is close to them. He's near to them. He sees it. He's not locked away behind the curtain. He's not locked up in the temple. He sees their lives. He sees what's going on. And he dwells with them. He's a witness to the things that they do. And that's why he speaks to them about it. He can see them. Wherever they are, it seems that God can see them. He's very near to them. The prophet is just his servant, the errand boy, the running boy. But God is actually with them in everything they do, in everywhere they go. He's not hidden. He sees them. And in his word, they get to see him through his word. And they get leadership from him and guidance from him and help and shape from him. And they get to move through this world to the destination that he's given them through the word. Every person who's ever played games, you can't play a game unless it has laws. Unless it has rules and laws, you can't play the game. But the person who sets good laws and good rules for the game gives you great joy, isn't it? There's great joy when you know that you're being guided, wisely guided, by one who understands life, and God understands life like nobody else. Finally, I think it just says, when we look at this final murder, chapter 35, 30 there, this observation of this murder that takes place, there is a prefigurement there of the very worst of murders, isn't there? There is a time coming, which is obviously not even seen, because God doesn't just see the situation as it is, but he sees the situation as it shall develop. And just as he looks back to Cain and Abel and takes this law from the horrors of that, it also looks forward, doesn't it, to the time when one will come amongst them who will be innocent and he will be killed. A person will be killed, that person. And the consequence of that death will be that the person who is responsible for the death, though they run, though they hide, they will, as it says in verse 35, there will be no ransom for them. They will be held guilty, and they themselves must be put to death. So if we're thinking about the death of Christ, we can see that there is a guilty stain, isn't there, upon people. And it says here, as you go down, that the land itself, the earth itself, is stained and becomes polluted by the blood of the one who has been murdered. There's a curse, isn't there, on the earth because of the very worst of all murders. But the question is asked there in verse 33. You shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land. No atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed. And then it says, except at the end. Except by the blood of the one who shed it. So human race is in a terrible predicament. Christ has been killed at our hands. And either on the one hand, we're going to have to accept responsibility for that and bear the guilt and the punishment for it. Or the one who has shed it, it's proved in the end, in the law court, as it were, that the person who shed it was not us, but somebody else will take responsibility. And we read in the scriptures in the New Testament that God takes full responsibility. He gave his one and only son that whoever should believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life. So if God says, I have given him to you, the guilt is removed and we can go free. Only if the one who says, I myself have taken in the responsibility for it himself, that's the only way that people can be set free. There's a prefigurement, isn't there, of the death of Christ there. And with Christ comes a New Testament with a new unfolding of life and law. You give us this new commandment that you should love one another. And in receiving this, we realize that he has drawn near to us once again in the God-man, Jesus Christ. So the third thing is that law is a sign that God is near. Now I'd like to pray and just commit us to God before we sing our final hymn.